Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Alejandra Bronfman. My guest today is Dylan Robbins, and I'm talking to him about his new book, Audible Geographies in Latin America, Sounds of Race and Place. It was published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2019. The book sits at the intersection of studies of race making as situated in place and sound studies approached via technology and with attention to the voice. It's a stunning and new way to think about Cuba and Brazil from the late 19th century to the 1960s. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hi, Dylan. Welcome.
Hi, Alejandra. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you about my book. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk to you about this book. But I want to start with just you telling us a little bit about how did you get the idea for this book? Where does the idea come from?
I think that the final organization of the book and its overall set of questions evolved over time from my dissertation project in a languages and literatures cultural studies department, Spanish and Portuguese, and that initial project. I was interested in trying to understand music and citizenship, or popular music and citizenship in Cuba and Brazil. And the concept of citizenship, I think, I originally was approaching through more classical political theory, and was driven by concerns with participation and presence. And any ways in which folks who might necessarily see themselves resonated or reflected in the state might otherwise try to manifest themselves publicly. And I think that project reached a certain level of saturation and exhaustion because of the kinds of sources that I was working with. I found myself in some ways trying to look past the sources, many of them, state-sponsored intellectuals or state-sponsored initiatives. In that initial project, I was almost kind of trying to reconstruct a little bit too deliberately from these sources what those other subjectivities could be. And over time, I realized that the story that maybe I was more interested in telling or that seemed more productive was to just better understand these sources, because they were so strange in some cases, that I guess many of our conventional assumptions about what a state-sponsored, mechanism of control or social control could be seem to break down. And that is in some ways how the present organization of the book came about, was becoming less concerned with doing the work of reconstructing something through sources and rather just trying to understand the strangeness of some of the sources that I had in front of me.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah. I always tell my students the story is in the sources.
Yeah.
So why Cuba and Brazil?
Well, I think there are personal motivations there that then later became more clearly intellectual or material. you know, I guess in a former life as a musician, much of the music that I was interested in and which I played was from the Americas, from the Caribbean and from Brazil. And then it's different connections with North American music. The two large poles, I think, for Afro-diasporic musics, some of the larger poles for Afro-diasporic musics in the Americas are Brazil and Cuba, and, you know, obviously the United States, among other places. So it was initially a connection made through music and musical production, which may not at all be evident in the book because so little the book is actually talking about music. But the connection was initially one that was through that map of the Afro-Americas that is in some ways formed by those places. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I think of your book as putting into conversation the work of Anna Ochoa, Jonathan Stern, Stéphane Palmier, Fred Moten, and then layering in people like Arcadio Díaz-Quiñones and others. So does that seem fair? Are there other people that you sort of drew inspiration from?
No, I think that's a very fair assessment. Yeah, I think that's the major framework there. Clearly folks who work at the intersection of anthropology, sound studies, cultural studies, musicology, literary studies or literary analysis, and who are all informed in some way, shape or form by, I guess, the Latin American and Caribbean variants of post-colonial studies. And critical race theory, which is a complicated tangle of things, I think, just because of the very different histories of the Americas, of some of the concerns that inform those areas of inquiry. I think from the vantage point of the North American Academy, and I'm certainly, you know, this book was a struggle with that, is the difficulty in engaging a theoretical production from Latin America and the Caribbean, which is something that, as I, you know, go through the book again, I continually feel is somehow unfinished work in the book, is to find ideas about sound, about the voice, for example, that are, I guess, more contextually specific to the realities of Latin America and the Caribbean. I think one of those places that I do some of that work in a way that I've felt a little happier about in the book is in the discussion of voice, which just in English, you know, has a set of connotations because of the way that term can be used both literally and figuratively in English. And then it has another set of connotations entirely when we look at the word voz in Spanish or voz in Portuguese, because of the kinds of expressions that word can be used in those languages, really open doors upon new ways of thinking theoretically about the voice. I think in the chapter that I have on the laboratory of experimental phonetics in Cuba, there's a moment where the use of voice, which can mean dialect or idiom in Spanish, it somehow collapses with voice as actually that which is produced by the sound, which is produced by the body, right? And there seems to be some slippage in the work that's done there. And it's, I think, precisely because there's that simultaneity of different meanings with that same word in Spanish that doesn't exist, for example, in English, that this sort of unusual thing takes place there that tells us something about the voice as a concept in a Spanish-speaking context that you don't necessarily get in an English-speaking context. Yeah.
I loved that chapter, and I want to get back to it because I found it really, really fascinating. But before we get there, I just wanted to get through to a couple of things first, because it sort of, that chapter comes at a specific place almost in your argument. And I wanted to talk a little bit about some other things that you do before that. And one of them is that there's this kind of double thing that happens in this book that was, to me, really exciting. One is you take on the work of some authors that people write about a lot that we think we know, people like Fernando Ortiz or Nina Rodriguez, right? You find just all this new ways to talk about them. So that's on the one hand. And then on the other hand, you bring in these stories about technology and kind of little known artifacts like the speech lab, which I found completely fascinating and we'll talk about more. But then also technologies that, again, we think we know, but you give us these whole new ways to think about them. And you start with the phonograph, right? And the book kind of opens with the phonograph. And you tie it into racialization. And that's, it's in dialogue with people like Michael Denning and Alexander Wehely, but you also take that in a really different direction. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your decision to introduce the book with the phonograph and sort of use that to sort of set up the whole book, really.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you. Yeah. That's one of the things I didn't mention, I guess, earlier when I was talking about some of the motivations of the book. And one of the things that makes this, what the final, I guess, organization of the book so much different than the project that I originally set out to do in the dissertation. And that is the realization that there's a story about technology here that I needed to somehow explore and unfold. And it probably goes back to a really wonderful story by the short story writer Horacio Quiroga about that Julio Ramos addresses in his classic Desencuentros de la Modernidad, in which there's this orange juice machine that is somehow brought from afar. And which doesn't quite work right in the context. And there's like a really interesting story there about technology and environment. I think it's an ongoing theme too, like in studies of silent film in the Americas and certainly with recording technology in the Americas, whether I think of Ruth Glasser's book, My Music is My Flag, in that beginning section where she talks about the RCA Victor steamship that would go from port to port and the different ways that people's musical instruments might be altered to be recorded and so forth. And I guess it just seemed that maybe through the actual device itself, there was a story to tell that had more to do with that moment of inscription and recording and less to do with that moment of distribution and consumption. Which I think is something that I really got from Denning's work. For example, it's that kind of decolonization of listening is really dependent upon that moment of reception and consumption. And I think there's another story there about that moment of inscription or recording that there's an interesting transfer or transformation that's taking place. So the phonograph has a really interesting sort of history, in my opinion, there's more to tell than what I could put in the book about its reception in Brazil. And it's this really ambivalent treatment. I mean, there's a lot of skepticism about what the use of the phonograph could be in that context. And this is, of course, before the phonograph was seen as an instrument to record music with and to distribute music, but rather just something that was related to speech and certain ideas about the human voice. And not unlike you see in the United States with the telegraph, in Brazil, there's a almost supernatural understanding or approach to the phonograph that is within the unique context that it's received in Brazil, also tied into notions of spirit possession and trance. And coincidentally, not necessarily the spirit possession and trance that one would see frequently cited as part of Candomblé or any of the Afro-diasporic religious practices in northeastern Brazil. but also that you would see in Spiritism, like the sort of socially more prestigious or more acceptable forms of mysticism that was extremely popular among the Brazilian elite at that time, to the effect that you even have this one who I talk about briefly in the chapter on the phonograph in Brazil in the 1890s. You have this one really sort of boring Latinist grammarian who had taken it upon himself to root out all the Anglicisms and French loan words and Brazilian Portuguese and some of his other work, begins writing a column in a newspaper called O Fonógrafo, or the Phonograph, in which he channels the spirits of different deceased Brazilians and also people from thousands of years ago, commenting on the birth of the Brazilian Republic, which is a really odd thing in a way. And there it was, and featured in a really important newspaper at the time. And so on the one hand, you have, this reception of the phonograph. And then on the other hand, you have the medical school in Bahia, in which, there's work being done on how the phonograph can permanently alter your consciousness and how great care should be exercised in listening to phonograph, because it could make you in some ways an inadequate citizen. And this, of course, is taking place within the context of discussions about mass trance episodes, a dancing plague that was apparently witnessed in Salvador da Bahia and other parts of the state of Bahia, northeastern Brazil at that time, and which received press before even Nino Rodrigues started writing about it. It was a cause of concern in the Gazeta Médica da Bahia at the time. And so there seemed to be this network of associations related to the ownership of one's voice, and that were accompanied both by the presence and the reception of the phonograph at that time in Brazil, and then at the same time with the study of mediumistic religions. And the cases that interested me the most were those in northeastern Brazil related to the Candomblé. So I don't know if that responded entirely to the question.
Absolutely,
about why the phonograph was there, but that's...
Well, it does. I mean, it opens up all of these different stories at once, right? And in the middle of it is this phonograph, which, like I said, we think we know this. We've had wonderful work by, Lisa Gittleman and all these other people, but you just bring in so many new and different kinds of stories to it. So I thought that was really fascinating. And then you move to Nina Rodriguez and Ortiz, which, as I said earlier, we also thought we knew those guys. And you really show us the ways that they're listening for race. That was just so fascinating to me. And I think, how did we, including me, because I've written about Ortiz, miss that, And so I would love to hear more about the process by which you arrived at that.
Oh, wow. I think that's a difficult question. I think it's a natural point of entry into a lot of the problems that I was interested with. I mean, Ortiz he was so prolific and he was so present and so, in some ways opinionated
right.
Pretty much the whole, 20th century history of studying Afro, Cuban ethnicities, in some ways, even with the recuperation of many of the 19th century texts that I was interested in the discussion of Ortiz, it's like all paths in some way have to kind of cross through him, or something that he's edited, mm-hmm. or re-edited or recovered or actively ignored as well. So I think that there was the listening for racialized speech, or the listening for blackness that is in Ortiz. I realized that it was something that he was getting from early Cuban grammarians and dialectologists who were interested in Cuban speech and language. And then his contribution is to try to invert the pathologization of this speech and offer it as an emblem of Cuban speech, while he has contemporaries like Diego who are actively trying to eradicate it from Cuban speech, any element that could be perceived as an Africanized feature of Cuban Spanish. But I think the 19th century intellectuals that Ortiz was reading were more interested in lexicographical features of Spanish, and so actual words that could somehow be traced back to having a West or a Central African origin. However incorrect or inaccurate those sources may have been in some of their assumptions. And by the end of the 19th century, and with the transition already elsewhere beyond Cuba, the transition from philology to phonetics, that is from, you know, a transition from a textual engagement with language to an actual experiential relationship to language. There's all of a sudden the possibility for thinking about the very sounds of Cuban Spanish as having some kind of origin elsewhere that is not the Iberian Peninsula necessarily. And that's where the experimental phonetics laboratory comes into place. And I think that, you know, Diego is someone I first found out about by reading his preface to Ortiz's lexicon of Africanized Cuban Spanish words. This is kind of very terse, very reserved preface where, you know, it's probably one of the most uncongratulatory things that he could have ever written to preface the book. I mean, it's hard to tell that he really wanted to write that preface.
Ortiz got a lot of praise, so, you know, he could probably take him down a notch or two.
Absolutely,
maybe.
Because, you know, you could also write, and that's one of the things that's so difficult for me about reading Ortiz is because, you know, at the same time that he's celebrating these Africanized features of Cuban Spanish, you know, he's also calling for an end to Haitian and Jamaican braceros or labor coming work on sugar plantations, right?
Yeah.
He's not a champion in any clear sense of Black Cuban culture, as we all know, right? And yet, curiously, his work is an important window and resource upon some of the things, even despite his best intentions or worst intentions.
Well, he does bridge this. Yeah, I mean, he does. I mean, he bridges so many stages, actually. And if you follow, you know, the whole career, it's kind of mind-boggling how many things he does. But he does, in terms of the lexicon, I was thinking about that because, of course, there are all of these kinds of glossaries in the backs of his books, right? And then the transition to thinking about speech phonetically and sonically also has to do with the technology, right? It has to do with the capacity to measure and to visualize, as you say in the chapter about the speech lab. So he does kind of bridge all of these different things. And the other thing that I thought was really interesting about that whole moment was that, there's a lot of stuff about Creole languages in the Caribbean and Haitian Creole and Jamaican Creole and those kinds of things. But I think that the Spanish speaking islands haven't been sort of incorporated into that set of literatures because the idea is that they don't really have Creoles, right? And I think that what your work really shows is the ways that they did and do and the kinds of repressive maneuvers that went on around them.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's there seems to be this ongoing question is within the study of Spanish dialectology. Lipsky's work, for example, is a whole book dedicated basically to trying to understand why is it that the Spanish, why didn't Spanish creolize in the way that other languages did? And I think it's a fascinating question because it's also, sort of the window upon all the different social relationships that go into creating a language, right? And just the concrete circumstances of what it probably was to speak a language that wasn't your own in a very isolated environment like that many slaves were living in the rural areas of Cuba at the time. How do we account for the fact that level of creolization didn't take place that you see, for example, in, let's just say, Colombia, in La Costa, in San Basilio, or, you know, how do you account for Papiamento? And this is really, as someone, I'm not trained as a sociolinguist, but because of my background in languages and literatures, these are questions that I've explored in through some of my other work, but not with these same sources, I guess, which is why it was fun to return to it here.
Yeah.
I guess. Yeah.
So let's talk more about this speech lab. So maybe a small description of what it actually was, because I found it fascinating in terms of what kinds of tools and technologies were being used, the tongue shaper and all of those kinds of things. And then how did you find it? It seems like there's really not that much to go on, right? You have a few archival traces, but not that much.
Absolutely.
So
it's there's very little written about it, and apparently its work was never really brought to fruition because of problems with the equipment and the not being able to get certain key items to do the work. So it's not clear exactly what those circumstances are, and I would love to be able to do more archival work with a DEagle archive to understand that better. But it's interesting because it was the only experimental phonetics laboratory in Latin America for its time. And so it was a very unique endeavor for the region, right? And yet, in any of the commemorations of Diego upon his retirement in the 1940s, there's no mention made of the laboratory or any of its work. And yet, at the time that the laboratory was created, right when the University of Havana moves to its present location, there's a lot of written about it, right? As to, you know, it's all laid out. You can see pictures of its different rooms, of its different equipment, and there are descriptions of the kind of work that it's going to be done, that it's going to be done there. And there's also mention of the kind of designs that Diego had for Spanish, Cuban Spanish, and other of his work on Cuban dialect. So from there, I was able to piece together an overall project there, which I try to lay out in the book, which is really a story that's also told through the actual objects and the instruments that are there, the actual technology that's there. And so you mentioned the tongue guides that there's an image of there in the book, which, you know, they're wooden handles, these metal bars bent in different ways, and they're there to show a speaker where their tongue should be placed to pronounce different sounds. And the counterpart of that too is a technique that was used in experimental phonetics at the time, which is this palate print an artificial palate would be placed in someone's mouth with different powders or inks, and they would be asked to pronounce different sounds, and the way the tongue would, you know, touch against the palate would leave a mark. And that mark is described not just by Diego, but by other experimental phonetics specialists at the time, as a mapping of a nation, of a race, through the movements of its tongues, and therefore of the sound that would be produced through the exact placement of the tongue at that point. So there are these instruments that sought to quantify by visualizing movements that were really not seen as significant just 20 years before or 30 years before, as a way of trying to pinpoint the exact specificity of a language through its sounds. And that for me was just really fascinating. I just got so carried away with it, probably too much so, but it was clear that certain sounds, certain consonants, D's, R's, L's, pronounced in a particular way were perceived as a quote-unquote contamination or a deviance or more specifically, a vice, un vicio, that in some ways departed from what was Peninsular Spanish or what would be an adequate Cuban Spanish. And this is the way in which whiteness was coded for Diego and many of his contemporaries. Yeah.
I mean, the mapping on of race onto those, I mean, it's really fascinating, and it does resonate with, you know, the Museum of Anthropology, which was existing in the University of Havana at the exact same time, was doing those kinds of things with, you know, the kinds of the forceps and the head measuring and all of that kind of stuff. So they're really kind of mapping bodies and race, and in your case, sound, making the voice part of the body in this very kind of concrete, scientific, scientized way. It's fascinating.
And I think your first book was really important in helping me understand different ways to approach that too. So, as you know.
Well, I did not mean to make that into an advertisement for my book.
No, I don't think there needs to be an advertisement for your book for anybody in our area. I mean, you know. I don't think no need to advertise what's already well known, but.
So I want to move on to chapter 4 because I found the way that you shaped that chapter really cool. In the way that it pulls together Cuba and Brazil, right? Because in the book, you sort of move back and forth between the two places, but this chapter in a way just pulls them together. And you do that by telling us about Mario de Andrade's reading of Alejo Carpentier's novel, Ecue Yamba O, and literally the pencil marks in the margins, right? And so you use that as a kind of device to think about how one intellectual is reading the work of another and sort of thinking about sound through that text. And it's really fascinating. So I wonder if you could, and then it sort of walks us backwards through how did we get to that point, right? So I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about why you organize the chapter that way and how it sort of contributes to the broader argument that you're trying to make.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I think the time period that chapter attempts to address, the 1920s and 1930s and the ascendancy of the national popular state in many parts of the world, and that strange inversion that takes place where all of a sudden Afro-diasporic musical and performing cultures can become emblematic of a nation, whereas just a few years before they were seen as in some ways strictly criminal, all the while also continuing to be criminalized. I mean, let's just be very clear about this. It seemed to me the hardest period to talk about in a way. And although there's so much written about this period and there's so much written about Mario de Andrade and about Alejo Carpentier and specifically about their interest in popular music, despite a lot of that work, there seem to be some questions that remain for me about why Mario de Andrade could be interested in Alejo Carpentier, because although they may have had shared interests in Afro-diasporic cultures, they couldn't be more different in some ways. I think Mario de Andrade, you know, was a very proud Brazilian nationalist. And I think Carpentier, especially at this moment, had a very ambivalent relationship to Cuba. And the idea of a Cuban nationalism was more interested in a kind of pan-Antillean sense of territory. And one really deeply rooted in Afro-diasporic cultures and the Haitian Revolution. And whereas Mario de Andrade didn't want too much blackness in his Brazil, so to speak. Whereas for Carpentier, being black was synonymous with being Cuban, as it was for his contemporary Nicolas Guillen. And yet they're so interested in some of the same things. They're interested in trance, they're interested in musical performance, they're interested in dance, they're interested in musical instruments, and as material objects. They're both interested in avant-garde aesthetics and surrealism. for example, and what's taking place in Western Europe in terms of this sort of Afrophilia that you see in Paris, to be sure, but also in other parts of Western Europe. They're also both interested in what's taking place among the African American in the African American or Black American intellectual tradition. So the idea was to start with Marijun Draghi reading L'Alejo Carpentier to somehow foreground the strangeness of the book, I guess, as being the bridge between their two interests in sound. They really depended upon writing and reading and the circulation of the book to get their work out and become familiar with other people's work. And yet at the same time, they were both deeply invested in music, performed music that couldn't be recorded necessarily, or recordings of music as well. Both of them dabbled in radio to different extents. Marijun Draghi created a really important library of vinyl records, of discs, with another musicologist in Sao Paulo at the time, which still exists, still there today. You can consult it there. There was a media consciousness for both of them that manifested in different ways. So the fact that these markings in Ecuajambo existed in Marijun Draghi's library, which is preserved at the University of Sao Paulo at the Instituto Superior de Estudos Brasileiros, was I guess one of those little snapshots of something that happened for me. And I was just, for me, it was so unexpected and so odd in a way, because from my understanding before ever finding out that Marijun Draghi had read Carpentier's first book, Ecuajambo, is that, you know, that was a book that Carpentier had disowned, that he didn't like. He thought it was kind of a pedestrian attempt at writing about a novel about an Afro-Cuban protagonist. And it is a fairly unsophisticated text in many ways. especially compared to some of his later work, right? It was published in Spain initially during his exile there, during the Machado regime in Cuba. And how did that end up in Mario's? How did Mario know about Carpentier? For me, I'm still puzzled by that, and yet this book is there. So through the things that interested Mario apparently in that text, I try to trace out a network of different relationships that they called upon in order to understand the relationships between diaspora and nationalism in that period, which is really the fundamental contradiction for me in this emergence of the national popular state. This nationalization of Afro-diasporic musical traditions enter into conflict with the fact that they're diasporic, and they move across national boundaries, and that you have these subjects that are moving across these national boundaries and speaking languages that aren't the imperial languages when they first come here. And those traditions in some ways map out this other geography that is not national. It's not.
Right.
I was intrigued to see how they struggled with that. And in the case of Marijun Draghi, you know, he was very, very critical of the influence of Cuban music and Brazilian music. He did not. He saw Cuban music as in some ways contaminating Brazilian popular music, as altering the samba form, as encouraging in some ways listeners to have something presented as samba that wasn't even samba, as in the case, as he talks about with El Manicero, or the peanut vendor, which he knew through American recordings largely, Marijun Draghi did, and which for him spawned a number of different genres of samba in Brazil, or variants of the samba genre in Brazil, that depended upon this sort of static harmony, this oscillation back and forth between, you know, two different chords. Que Baiana Tem is a composition that is most frequently cited, that is basically a son montuno form, and yet which is a song celebrating the baiana, and which some people see as a samba. But it you know, samba traditionally has a lot more harmonic movement. There are chords that fly by in a samba, or they can, especially in that time period. And that song is harmonically very static. It's more characteristic of what you hear in the Somme at the same time of the 1930s. And for Mari Chandraji, this is evidence of a blackness that moves across national borders in the Americas, and which complicates the really specific project he had for the formation of a national Brazilian sound through this somewhat even mix of both Amerindian, Afro-diasporic, and Portuguese European influences that were supposed to fuse to create what he thought was a Brazilian race, so to speak. Carpentier could not have been less interested in anything like that. And I just think that's really funny. Yeah.
And yet there's this kind of convergence. It's really interesting. And I mean, one of the things about that chapter too is that you work across, I mean, music slips back in, but in this very sort of unexpected way, and you're working across all these different forms of media that, you know, the recording comes into it, but then also textuality and different forms of sound performance and recording and things like that. And then you know, in the final chapter, you introduce yet another medium, which is film. And again, the kind of transmedia approach is really important. And so in the last chapter, you talk about noise and the Cuban Revolution and in film. And so maybe we can start to wrap up with you talking a little bit about why noise and why does it matter? Why does it matter in the Cuban Revolution?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think that noise is one of those concepts that has been explored significantly, right? It felt daunting to even I had a hard time deciding that I should even talk about noise because of there's so much to do with that concept. As you know, anybody who works in sound studies knows. I mean, there's so much written about it. But the focus on the technology of film production allowed me to narrow it down to the kind of noise that I was interested in. And the realities of Cuban film production beginning in the late 1950s and into the 1960s, which is the period I'm really interested in this chapter. It is engaging with a certain new circumstance with sound recording and the portability of sound recording to make documentary film. And noise in that case is all that excess, all that's everything that was inadvertently recorded with the sound recorder as part of the camera and the street approach to making documentary. What do you do with that noise? At the same time, there was an ongoing discussion, especially in the first years of the revolution, as to what would constitute a revolutionarily acceptable sound in public. As I discuss in the chapter, the jukebox is initially banned, right? Because it's seen as noisy.
Right.
And that band is eventually reversed. And just to get a sense of just how significant the discussion about the jukebox noise was, I mean, Fidel Castro participated apparently directly in that discussion, right? I mean, he participated in a lot of discussions because, you know, he was quite the micromanager, as we all know, right? So, but nonetheless, it was significant enough that he actually became directly involved in the conversations. And so what was initially a ban of the jukebox was later reversed. And the justifications for that reversal of the ban of the jukebox had to do with acknowledging that the sounds of the jukebox were the sounds of productivity, right? That there was a whole industry behind there. There were people who repaired the machines. There were all the different artists who depended upon it in order to be heard because they didn't perform and so forth. And once it was understood to be an industry engaged in a certain kind of productivity, then all of a sudden those could be considered to be favorable industrial noises. At the same time, you know, you have the history of noise ordinances, which you have also written about in your work on the carnival and the beginning of the 20th century in Cuba, right? Which became a mechanism of control for Afro-Cuban populations, right? So noise ordinances, as they still are, right, are just part of the story, just the tip of the iceberg. Right. So they're geared towards the prohibition of certain instruments, of certain dances, of certain festivals, of certain rituals. And that was another ongoing discussion within the Cuban Revolution as to how to take the quote unquote noise of the drum and make it revolutionary. And that culminates for me in some ways in this short documentary film that I talk about there on the first socialist carnival, in which, you know, you have the neme, or these abakwa, figures who are dressed in this, you know, traditional costume that's been documented since the 19th century in Cuba, and been the very visual representation of a criminal organization for some early white Cuban intellectuals, right? All of a sudden, these become emblematic of the Cuban Revolution and a resistance to North American imperialism. And there's a story about noise there that I try to tease out and how it becomes nationalized and in some ways politicized as part of a socialist agenda.
I mean, part of the what you suggest and what you show in the chapter also is this ability of so many Cuban filmmakers to sort of be part of the debate, but also comment on the debate even as they're taking part. And so, like, you can never quite tell if it's a critique or a confirmation. Yeah. And there's a way to double read almost everything that a Cuban filmmaker makes. So.
Absolutely. I think that's that excess, right? It's all that stuff they capture and don't necessarily set out to do.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. I've taken up lots of your time, but just as a way to kind of maybe bring this into the present, the book ends in the 1960s, and maybe that's, and it's plenty, certainly. But I wonder if you think that there are any resonances that carry us into the present. Are there ways that rethinking this kind of past moves us into a different kind of future? I'm thinking of David Scott, of course, here. But I was just wondering, just curious to hear your thoughts about any ways that these kinds of issues resonate today, if you think they do at all. They don't have to.
Yeah. I think they do. I think that, you know, the book ends with a little note, really, that tries to reestablish a continuity between North America and Latin America as a geography of that has a shared history despite its many differences, what I sense about the present is also what I fear, and I think the excess of the present and the density of the moment is so overwhelming for me that it's hard for me to even put into words.
The present that you were writing in is a very different from what it is now, even, right? So, like, so many things have changed.
I don't know if I can answer that question.
That's okay. I don't know if I can.
Yeah.
I don't.
Really.
I think the
media has changed. I mean, the media technologies overlap in interesting ways, but the landscape seems to have changed significantly. And yet the common problems moving across, and I'm so shocked by what's taking place in the United States right now that it's really hard for me to even articulate I think the relationship to the book in a way, or to some of the problems described in the book. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, also Brazil, right? Because Brazil is
absolutely
undergoing its own sort of set of crises.
As we see, for example, you know, drug traffickers contracted by evangelical groups to attack candomblés. And it's like, okay, so I've seen this before in the historical record, but no, I haven't seen this before in the historical record. You know,
yeah.
It's something very similar about it, and at the same time, something just incomprehensible, like that I really don't, that I'm having a hard time processing. Yeah.
Well, it's just, I mean, in some ways, it's a matter of putting these things in the same analytical lens. We have become even more dependent on the media and on technologies and on sort of hearing people's voices and all of that kind of thing, literally and figuratively. And, you know, the issues of corporation racialization have certainly not gone away.
I think too, just going back to something I mentioned before, and sorry if this is redundant, but I think that there's a way in which I continue to grapple with how the language that we have and that we use really sort of corrals us or guides us towards being able to come to certain kinds of conclusions. And that's one of the things that's part of the work that I think the book really wanted to do, was to visit some concepts within sound studies and to ask, you know, what would their valence be if approached from another language? As I mentioned before with The Voice, or another one that I was thinking about, which comes up in the Mario Gendragi and Carpentier chapter, which is Contratiempo, or which would be upbeat, in translated to upbeat in English. But Contratiempo in Portuguese can mean so many different things. It can mean setback. It can mean, you know, out of placeness as well. It doesn't just strictly mean upbeat. And so how these concepts, just because of the words, can map into different places, either inhibit or encourage thinking through certain things. And so I think about the present. I'm struggling with how maybe some of the closed doors of the present might be because of the language we're using. But I don't know. I don't think the solution is there.
No, I mean, not a solution, but we don't need a solution.
Yeah.
But it is true that one of the things that your book does very beautifully is not directly and not in a kind of accusatory way, but really sort of point to the unquestioned whiteness of sound studies for such a long time. I mean, that's changing, and it's changed. It's been changing for a while, but the initial and admittedly brilliant work of a lot of the sound studies people had this kind of unquestioned Northern, you know, European perspective. And you don't need to sort of make a huge point of it, but the whole book does make that point.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you. It has been such a pleasure, as always, talking to you today.
No, Alejandra, no, it's been a pleasure. Yeah. Thank you so much for the insightful questions and the opportunity to talk about the book with you. Yeah.
It's delightful.